session number 21189, Rule 1.
Mr. Kwiatkowski, Rule 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Płock, which is a town on the Vistula River, north of Warsaw. It's a historical town in Mazovia, dating back to the 10th, 11th century.
Did you, both your mother and father come from Płock?
Well, from that district.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, my father was an estate agent, a real estate agent, in Warsaw. At his office is in Nowy Świat Street in when the war broke out. And but both my parents, my mother, Marianna Osiecka, came from families, and both my father's work came from families which lived in that of Poland for centuries and still live till today. You know, I got relatives living both in Płock and in the surrounding countryside.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in the Płock area?
No, when I was a little boy, my parents moved to Warsaw. I don't know how old I was, 5 or something. So I was brought up in Warsaw, and I consider myself a Warsawian.
Can you remember the 1st of September 1939, what happened to you?
Yes, exactly. I was, well, the new school, I was in a grammar school at the time. I was supposed to start the third form of grammar school in Warsaw. But because of the mobilization, which the part mobilization of the Polish army, a lot of the teachers in grammar schools were reserve officers in the Polish army reserve, and they were called in. So it played havoc in the schools, and also in general, the new school year was postponed. And I found myself, my brother and I, went to stay with a friend of ours, whose parents had a villa in Świder, which is a small place outside Warsaw, with mostly built up with villas, people who lived in Warsaw, they had their small villas outside Warsaw, like the Russians, the Dutchies, you know, where they lived during the summer. And my friend's parents had a villa, and we were spending the time there. And on the 1st of September, we were awakened. I don't know, 6 o'clock in the morning, by the noises of aeroplanes and bombs and so on. And we didn't believe that the war broke out, because a few days earlier there was air defense exercises in Warsaw, and they made them so realistic that they did explode, explosions, set, you know, fires and so on, place bombs along the street, you know, and that so on. So we thought that that was an extension of that air defense exercises. And, but, you know, the whole thing was getting, bombs were falling near and near, everything was shaking. And one of us got on a bicycle and went to the nearest town, Otwock, and he came back and he said, yes, the war has started. And we had a crystal radio set, and we switched it on. And the first word which I heard was, although the war has started, that was the person, I think it was called Colonel Umiastowski, if I remember correctly. He was head of information service of the Polish army. So now we knew that a war broke out. At one stage we saw some planes flying above our heads, and we came out and we looked, and there was just single German bomber flying, and there were two or three Polish fighter planes attacking the plane, and they shot him down. He caught fire as a result of this attack, and it came down, and we had to run like mad because it looked that the plane is heading straight for us, and eventually it fell 300 yards away from us. So there were four of us, we ran there, and we were the first to see the plane, which was shot down by the Polish Air Force. Well, on Sunday, the 3rd of September, the father of the boy whose stay came down and coming back to Warsaw, and that was of course the day where France and Britain declared war on Germany. So there was great euphoria, you know, that now we shall win the war. Britain and France kept their word and we entered into the war. And of course, things, you know, didn't turn out very well, and Warsaw was under constant bombardment by the German Air Force. And I was in a Polish scouts, but our troop leader volunteered for the army, and he left me a note to take over the charge of the troop, although I was only, well, I wasn't quite 15 yet. And one of the tasks which our troop was given was to form a service with what you could describe a National Health Service office as messengers. Anyway, we lived in the old town in Warsaw. The office was in Cherniaków, which is along the Vistula River farther down. We went there and I tried to set it up, and I and another friend, we went with a message to the Polish town, to the Warsaw town hall. As we were walking up Książęca Street, which goes up the hill, it was next air raid, and people started running in panic, and some people started shouting, "Gas!" Well, the two of us decided that gas or no gas, we got a message to deliver, so we will deliver it. But because there was a gas and we had no gas masks, we were trained before the war at the scouts, that if you haven't got anything else and there is a gas attack, the one way of protecting yourself is to take a piece of cloth and pee on it and cover your mouth and nose, because ammonia was to act as a deterrent. So that's what we did. We pulled our scout scarf off, turned towards the wall, pee, put them over our mouth, and walked up. As it turned out, of course, there was no gas, you know. So we got to a tram, and then we took our scout scarves off and started waving to dry them off. But that might be of, you know, I'm mentioning this because it's, I don't think anybody else has done it, you know. And on the 8th of September, my father came back from the office, and he bought a cart and a horse and decided that he would take us out, that my wife, my mother, and my brother and myself, to stay on a farm outside Warsaw with one of his customers, you know, and that he will come back to Warsaw to carry on with his business. But of course, once we moved out of Warsaw, we didn't come back because the Germans were advancing, were going farther and farther east. Until on the 17th, we found ourselves near the town of Równe in eastern Poland, which is, oh, I don't know, 100 miles or so from the Soviet border. And the Russian artillery opened up fire until, obviously, there was fighting. And we learned that the Russians entered Poland. So my father decided that we would go back to Warsaw. And we came back to Warsaw. We reached Warsaw shortly after Warsaw capitulated. Well, for all practical purposes, Warsaw was in ruins. You couldn't, you could hardly get to the streets because all craters from bombs and artillery shells and ruins. And we got to the house where we had our flat. And the flat was on the top floor. And from the street, because it's a narrow street, you couldn't see the, you know, the top floor. So we dashed up the staircase and the sky opened. There was no top floor. Our flat was completely just ashes.
What was the address?
14 Piekarska Street. Its building has been rebuilt slightly, more or less in the same style, but not exactly the same. And the only thing which stays in my mind as we looked up towards the top floor, the legs of an iron bed, which was my bed, were hanging over the gap in the staircase. Anyway, that was already late afternoon, and there was a curfew at 7 o'clock. And although our friends and neighbors, you know, offered us, you know, to stay with them overnight, we couldn't because of the horses and the car. Somebody had to take care of them. So we moved out of Warsaw, and after traveling for a couple of days, we came to a town, small provincial town called Płońsk, which is about 70 kilometers north of Warsaw. And we stopped there on a farm, again, one of my father's clients. You know, I told you he was an estate agent. And he had to, and we stopped there. Well, the next was, it was a temporary stop that we'll go back to Poland. As it turned out, my father, my parents lived there till my father died in 1980, can't remember exactly the year, and my mother lived there longer. So we got stuck in this. One reason was that the Germans incorporated that part of Poland into the Reich, and there was a very strictly controlled frontier between what was called in central Poland the general government and the other parts which were incorporated into the Germany, and that part of Poland was called the Südostpreußen, or southern eastern Prussia. And so I lived the most of the time, but when the Germans started taking young people for work in Germany, I left Płońsk and stayed with my on my grandparents' farms for about 6 months. And they came back to Płońsk and got a job in a German shop as a shop assistant. But just to illustrate how the Polish resistance came into being, I would depart from a little bit from my personal experiences. In 1939, before Warsaw capitulated, Marszałek Śmigłowicz, who was the commander-in-chief of the Polish armed forces, nominated one of the Polish generals as the commander of the Polish resistance. I can't remember the name of the general. But, you know, it was one thing to nominate a commander and another thing to organize the resistance. But the resistance organization mushroomed all over Poland, you know, from various groups. And to illustrate that, I think in 1941, maybe 42, I got to know enough young people in Poland, because when we arrived there, I didn't know anybody, to trust each other. And we formed an organization. We called ourselves Young Poland. You know, it was part of the resistance. We didn't exactly knew what to do. I was 17, how to act, and go, but we thought, well, perhaps we can do something, like keeping records of the Germans and what they did, you know, and well, perhaps some army movements, record army movements, so, you know. But after a little while, and I'm mentioning this to illustrate how the resistance movement spread out, you know, sort of, you know, spontaneously. After a few months, we decided to dissolve ourselves, because if we were caught, we ran a high risk of being shot or sent to concentration camp. So that was the risk, and the benefit of the organization would be so minimal that we decided that it won't be worthwhile doing it. I did travel to Warsaw during that time several times. It was, the frontier was guarded and controlled, very strictly controlled. But I managed to get, by bribing a German official, to get official permit to travel to Warsaw. And I tried in Warsaw to establish some contact with underground in Warsaw, but I wasn't successful at that time. And I had been arrested on a couple of occasions where I was in Poinsk on minor offenses, like the police, German policemen found me in the street after a curfew and so on, but, you know, I was only kept overnight and released to go to work. But in 1943, November 1943, I was arrested by the Germans on more serious charges of black marketeering, stealing from the shops, selling things without coupons, and, you know, all sorts of economical sabotage, which, like most of the things in the German law, carried the penalty up to death, including the sentence, you know. Luckily for me, the German investigators were so stupid, you can say, so inefficient, so, you know, unintelligent, because I didn't quite know what they arrested me for. So when they were interviewing me, instead of asking me questions, I asked them questions and got all sorts of answers from them. So now I knew more or less where I stood. And then as a result of that, I could lie my way out of trouble. And they released me until my case would come up in court. But my mother was arrested in 1942 for buying meat in black market, and or for very complicated reasons, you know, reasons she, well, she was released and said that she will maybe called the court, you know, the case would be heard and she would be, you know, sentenced or what have you. And until then, the sentences for buying meat in the black market was 3 months in a local prison, and quite often, because the prisons were full of people arrested, so the Germans would release the person sentenced and call it back for the serving the sentence later. So my parents decided that she will appear in court, and hopefully she will be released before she will be called into prison. So then, depending on how severe the sentence is, we will decide what she will do, whether she will go back to prison or not. Because the problem was, with a small provincial town, you couldn't hide, you know, everybody knew everybody. The German police knew everybody almost personally, you know, so you couldn't go into easy hiding. And of course, the war didn't look that it would end soon, you know, so it meant a very long time, very and if you went into hiding and found that the penalty would be much more severe. Unfortunately, when my mother's case came up, the sentence was particularly severe, 10 months, and immediately from the courthouse to the prison. And the reason was that the chappie who was selling the meat was also selling it to the Germans. And the Germans were scared that this would come out somewhere, so they made sure that none of the prisoners could talk. By the way, the chappie who sold this meat, he played on the fact that he will, you know, the Germans, including the German police, were buying this meat on Bremer. So they finished him off in 3 months' time. He was there.
How did they do that?
Oh, we took him to prison, and after that you didn't know what happened, but the family was informed that he died, you know, that was it, you know. Anyway, my mother was taken to this prison for 10 months, and after the 10 months she was expired, she was sent to the Ravensbrück, the, you know, famous concentration camp for women. And luckily, she was in this concentration camp, she worked in some munition company. But even then, she probably wouldn't survive. But there was a Swedish diplomat, I can't remember his name, quite famous. And that was, must have been 1945 already. Himmler realized that Germany would lose the war, and he tried to find some sort of escape for him. So he contacted this Swedish diplomat, aristocrat, can't remember his name, was quite well known, and to try to establish some sort of contact and perhaps even discuss the surrender of Germany or what have you. But during that visit, of this Swedish cab, we were driving to the countryside near Berlin, and we saw some women working in the fields. And the Swede said, if Hitler wants to talk to him at all, he must release all these women. And Himmler did that. And quite a lot of the women prisoners were sent to Sweden. And my mother was among them. And the Swedes took great care of them. Because, you know, it was very dangerous. You couldn't just feed people up because they are dying of starvation. You have to be careful and psychologically and physically and so on. And so that's why my mother survived and she went back to Poland. But the reason why I'm mentioning this was that when I was released from my arrest, I wouldn't take any chances of going to court. And so my father organized an escape for me. I didn't know that at the time, but he was the AK, you know, the Home Army commander in Poinsk at the time. I didn't know that. And he organized an escape for me to Warsaw. And it was quite dramatic. I had a couple of very near, well, on one occasion I was actually caught, but thanks to a young girl whom I never met before, who pretended that I am her lover, started embracing me and kissing me and telling me that I went there because I wanted to make love to her. And the German, you know, accepted that. That was changing. Anyway, eventually I finished in Warsaw. And I went to stay with my uncle. And he arranged to make that identity card, which I showed, because it's a genuine German identity card. It's not a falsified one.
A Ken Carter.
Ken Carter, yes. And immediately, that was January 1944. And a few days after I joined the, got to Warsaw, I contacted my friends. Among them, one of those who invited me to Świdar, to his parents' villa, you know, in 1939. And they introduced me to the NSZ, Narodowe Siły Zbrojne, which was National Armed Forces, which was one of the big underground organizations, the second after the AK, which was by Myers, the biggest and most important, but the second largest was this National Armed Forces. Can we make a break now, please? When I joined the NSZ, I was sent, whatever, incorporated into a guard platoon of the HQ of the Warsaw region of the National Armed Forces. The title looks quite impressive. There were three reasons why I joined this particular organization. First, as the name suggests, this was an organization based of the National Democratic Party, which was recognized then, compared to the Tories. But also in that organization there were members of ONR, which was Obóz Narodowo-Radikalny, which is a camp of National Radicals Party before the war, which was, you could say, fascist organization. But it was stronger against German than any other, you know. So they had, if you like, you could tell them, for example, they were anti-Semitic. That was I'm talking about before war. And because some of the members of this ONR also were in the NSZ, it had a rather bad reputation among other political leaders in Poland. But basically the NSZ members were just as democratic as anybody else, and they were not anti-Semites. For example, I was a member of that organization, and yet for over a year I was helping Jews in the ghetto in Poinsk, risking my life. So that's how anti-Semitic I was. And the same with my other friends. They had right-wing opinions, but based all of them were, you know, Democrats, honest, decent people. But nevertheless, it was the political orientation of the organization was right-wing, and I always was, and I still am. Even in Britain, I am a right-winger. You know. The other reason was that when I joined the proper resistance, you know, I wanted to be active. I didn't want to be